It's interesting because I'd been hearing all these stories in personal accounts around me and articles I was reading by randomly about dementia. And it was descending on me. All these stories suddenly came out of nowhere at once, and I just couldn't get away from them. And so I thought the universe was saying something. Like when that happens, I realized you got to pay attention. I don't know what this is. Then I realized, oh, maybe I should write about it. And so at a certain point, I had some ideas for scenes that started popping up, scenario. And one afternoon, I sat down at my kitchen table and outlined the whole film, but just in crude way, you know, but it was the whole arc of the film, and it included that ending. And I don't know why it just came out that way, but it stayed throughout the whole process of writing the script and then many script changes when we got people involved and actors. But it was always that ending. But I don't know why. I think it was a pretty dark time in my life when I was writing it. It was very clear from the beginning. I didn't want to write this story. I didn't want to keep writing it because I didn't want to make a film about the elderly and dementia. It just, there's so many traps for cliche and sentimentality, and also nobody. It's like, does anybody want to really watch this? But I kept writing it despite that. It's like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to just do it the way I think is right, which is don't pull any punches. Dementia is one of the most difficult situations somebody can experience and a family can experience. And I know that from very personal, not my family, but very personal accounts. My dad's of Tom's age, and all of his friends around him are. So I was like seeped in that at the moment. And none of the stories are hopeful or redemptive or sentimental. So I wanted to just make it that way. It was just my intention to write a script, and not necessarily to make a film, but just write a complete script for my own sake. I'm writing about my own death anxiety is probably what's happening. I don't know if this is true or not. I don't want to try to psychoanalyze it too much. I'm a little worried about it, to be honest. I don't want to make a film this dark next time again for this. I personally find the meaning in life in works of art, in the poetry of works of art, in grief and in dark places. By dwelling in that space, it helps you ultimately understand the meaning of the joyful moments too. I think you have to address it consciously before you can, because if you don't, it keeps having an unconscious pull on you that sinks, that pulls you into an abyss. And so it's like you have to address it in art and have some sort of cathartic release through it. At least the art that I respond to, I'm always interested in those things. But it can finally overwhelm you when you dwell in that for so long, creating that. Like I wrote this script for many years and I lived in that space for too long. It starts to take a toll. And that was for my own mental health. You know, I actually have a very optimistic view on life, but that character, even though, you know, I wish she would have had more development, more screen time, is kind of the most important character to me, because it does say the cycle of life. Death happens, but then it's always replaced by fresh, hopeful, beautiful youth. And that's very reassuring to me. And it's reassuring to people at the end of life to know that their children and grandchildren, even if they don't have children, other people are having children and life is being replenished with youth all the time. I wanted to address that, but I wish I could have done it more, to be honest. I think I'm that character. That's my POV. When I did finally say, okay, I'm going to write this script. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it the right way for me. It's just for me. I'm just going to write. I'm not going to necessarily make this. When I was encountering these real life situations and stories that I'd read, I thought I had clear opinions about consent. But when it came to dementia and I read these accounts and experienced some of the things that other people were going through close to me, it's like, because there were sexual situations similar to this. And this is kind of a composite of many different. I felt very disturbed because I didn't know what I felt morally, and I still don't. And so I thought, okay, the right way to make this story is to make it from that position. Don't make it a sentimental, redemptive thing, because it's not. In real life, it's not. Just talk about your uncertainty and that your moral uncertainty, but also try to, I mean, I have an opinion. It's very clear. Martin should not be having sex with her. If there's any doubt that she may not be able to give true consent, then he simply needs to stop. Whether it's actually helpful, you know, helpful to her or not, what you can't do is risk harming her. But on the other hand, I understand how a man that's been with this person every day for 18 years, and dementia is a gradual decline. And so you can not see it happening because it happens in such slow glacial pace. And also you don't want it to happen. So there's a natural tendency to be in a little bit of denial or, you know, repressing it or suppressing it. And it takes somebody else from the outside to help you see it. So I can understand how he just simply doesn't see it. And especially because Leslie initiates the act, which is a common thing. But that potential, there are theories that's a result of the disinhibition that happens with the erosion of the brain. Primal instincts come back, sexual urges start to really become pronounced, and other things, you know, hunger, Juliet talks about this in the film, sex, hunger, sleep. There's no inhibition anymore. There's things are expressed. But even though she's initiating the act from maybe a primal place, you don't know if it's actually something that could be helpful or harmful to her. So, and there's just simply no way to know because they can't communicate at this point. So I was just very, very confused about who's in the right or in the wrong. It's not a binary thing. It's not either. So I wanted to talk about that, mainly to show how difficult it is for families that are actually facing this to navigate these incredibly excruciating situations. This was built out of workshopping, like a month of workshopping where we went through the entire script every day, the three of us. Well, it was Tom, Annie. We workshopped with everybody, but the most intensive one was Tom, Juliet, and Annie. We sat every day and just went through, you know, scene by scene, situation by situation, and talked about it through the script away. Like, we didn't look at it, but we kind of knew exactly what the beats were. And the desire was to bring all of these professionals' language and ideas about how scenarios should work and really collaborate. And my intention was to try to get something that's the most truthful out of each person, emotionally truthful. So if they didn't, something that was actually in the script was not really landing with them, we needed to change it so it was landing. So the script became very fluid at that point. Also, in that process, what luckily happened was there was a tremendous emotional bond between Tom, Annie, and Juliet, and they became a real family, loving. There's such humor and such silliness, and it was lucky that they really love each other, and they brought their own language. Tom contributed so many of his own lines that just became replacements for what I'd kind of sketched out, and everybody did, Juliet, and it was highly improvised in that stage, and those improvisations then became folded into a working draft of the script, and that's how that all happened. The people that play the professional, like the SOIT officer, the SARC doctor, the social worker, those are all actual, you know, that's their job in real life, and they aren't actors. Except for Michelle Jerram, who plays the SOIT officer. She was a SOIT officer, then she became an actress. Mm. And so that was another huge stroke of luck. The script changed radically for those situations too. They came on first as advisors to help. I needed to find out exactly how these situations would occur. And if this happened, what would happen? Oh, well, this would happen. It's not the way you wrote it. This would happen instead. So the script had to pretty significantly change the structure of, and at a certain point it didn't work anymore. And I was like, I don't know if we can make this film. I don't know where to go now. So they helped resolve all of those situations. And then I kind of knew I was going to try to cast them. When I was on the Zoom call, I said, I know that you could do this. I offered them the roles, and at first they thought about it, and then they all said yes. And we workshopped extensively with them. We went through a lot of rehearsals and we brought Juliet and Tom into those rehearsals too, and they integrated together. It was a film built out of the workshop process and giving the actors, really, really giving the actors the rein to take it where they wanted it to go. But then we rehearsed those scenes, rehearse it, and pretty soon we'd shoot it. At some point you have to say, I have to locate it somewhere. I want to write this script so that it could be shot anywhere, because I don't want the location to limit it. And I kind of don't want to shoot in the US right now, you know. But eventually I said, I got to locate it somewhere just so I can write the script and people can read it. And so I chose New York, and I was assuming I was just going to cast American actors. But then I always knew I was, any chance I could take and get it shot in Europe or England or something, I was going to do it. And that came when I said, I just want to cast Juliet. Like, I don't want to cast an American. I want to cast Juliet because she's the best actress in the world. And I want to see if she wants to do it. And she said yes. So, okay, well, I can still shoot it in the US, but okay, I'm not going to cast an American because I really want to cast for Tom or for Martin role. I really want Tom Courtney. He's my dream person. So I'm going to see if he wants to read the script. And he said yes. It doesn't make sense to shoot it in the US now. It needs to be in London because Tom's British. We could, you know, cast the rest of the cast with British actors. Juliet could have a British mother and a French father, and that would work. So it really just needs to be shot in London. Okay, let's do that. So then I called Tristan Gallagher and said, do you want to make this film in London? And he said yes, and that's how it happened. There's a certain amount of getting just railroaded. You just get shoved into an institutional process, which is designed with the best intentions to help and protect, but you can also get crushed in the wheels. Yeah, and that's all the actual response. That's the way the response would work in this situation. And that came from the professionals who are advisors. Like I was saying, Juliet's kind of my point of view. If I had one that was more closely aligned with the Juliet character, that's more like me, I think she had to call, but I wouldn't have known what would happen after. Like, I don't know what that would unleash. I wanted to show that experience of being like, how can you know that? You can't just go research it, like when you're panicking and you get stuck in it.
There's this issue of martial consent and rape within marriage, and there's quite a strong implication that there can be rape in a marriage. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about this issue, especially from the viewpoint of an older generation, like the couple in the film?
So there's a line that Tom says, they're arresting me for having sex with my wife. I was interested in showing the generational difference, because in the UK, I believe it was still legal to have sex with your wife without it being rape until the mid-90s.
It was the same in Germany, everywhere.
That's not my stance, but I wanted to show that that's part of that generation. For me, it's if it's your wife or anybody and she isn't giving clear consent, then it's rape. It's confusing for somebody of that generation. And he doesn't think it's rape because he believes she's truly giving consent, but he should shouldn't be having sex with her, but he just is not, he doesn't understand yet. That happens. It's based upon, I had stories I'd read, experiences I'd had seen in, not in my family, but in people that I know. And it was very, very confusing to me. And I wanted to show the point of view of all those characters involved in these stories that I'd been experiencing and would not put my thumb on the scale and not moralize. But my, you know, my view is very clear that Martin shouldn't be having sex with Leslie. If there's any chance at all that you can't know with certainty that she's giving true informed consent, then you simply can't risk it. But I understand how he may not see that yet because of how gradually the decline happens, how much he doesn't want to lose her. It's not an uncommon situation. So I wanted to put some light on that, let people see what these families are dealing with. And so it's much more archetypal, I think, for me, where it's fear of death. So, but it's an unconscious and primal fear of death. And sex is the antidote to death. It's the creative act. It's the ultimate symbolic and deeply felt sense of life and connection to life and creation of life. And I think in a very primal and archetypal way, we experience that. There is a very strong connection that sex-death dichotomy thing is actually, those things are on the same coin. So they live intimately together, but they're opposites. When you're having, especially like an unconscious and repressed sense of death anxiety, it makes sense that sex might become an activated sense for some people. I wanted to suggest that maybe it's not, he's acting from his own primal selfish place, fear of his own death, and he's trying to cling to life. And at the same time, it's not so simple. He also truly loves her, truly believes, he believes their intimacy is helpful to her. And this is from real stories that I've known. Well, I don't know. Who knows what she's thinking? We can't know. It may be helpful to her, maybe really harming her. And if there's any chance it's harming her, he shouldn't do it. But he doesn't believe it's harming her until at some point he understands it could be harming her, so he stops. But it takes Juliet to tell him that, you know.
But you do implicate that she initiates sex at least once in the film.
Yeah, I show it once, but I imply that it's happening multiple
even
times, often. But with that, I'm trying, and again, this is just from real situations that I've researched. I first heard about, then I further researched with geriatric psychiatrists. Tom says it in the film. It's split amongst geriatric psychiatrists whether this is harmful or helpful. Someone can initiate sex when they have dementia from a place of disinhibition, not from primal disinhibition. So it's a desire to eat, to sleep, to have sex, you know, to move. I think there's a high possibility, but we can't know. And that was what I really wanted to do with this film, is make a film. If I'm going to make a film about dementia, we can't know what the person suffering dementia feels. That's the point. What we can know is what they can't communicate it. So I don't want to take her point of view, because that would be preposterous. But you can know what the people around her are feeling, and maybe, and what they're feeling is opacity. You can't, she's opaque. How can you know how to best care for this person when you can't know what they're thinking? How do you make decisions on their behalf? How do you rob them of their own agency? You could be harming them by making choices for them. Probably accurate. They can't make the choices for themselves anymore. When you write a script, you never resolve everything. You just finally have to say, this is enough. Let's make it. But I had much, it went all over the place, you know. So there was the ex-husband was in the script. And in fact, he was living with them. There's versions where she did have sex with another person. And Sarah's story, the teenager, that was also much more, but it would have been a 5-hour film, you know. So I wish I would have been able to explore that more. But in the end, the choice was made for economy's sake to put up the visually alliterative situation of youthful sex and end of life sex. But you're right. Like, there's a story there that could have really been better, but it just didn't make it.
Leslie gets assaulted in a care home by mm-hmm. another inmate. Mm-hmm. Did you also research such terrible condition, even in mid-scale or higher scale care homes? Because that's a pretty expensive institution that she gets in.
Yeah, that came from a real experience that I know about. It was a slightly different situation, but yeah, it happens frequently. It's a disinhibition thing. There's actually quite a bit of sexual activity, not necessarily penetrative sex, but a lot of sexual activity that happens in care homes. It's not discussed very much, but it's very common. It's just because those things, the disinhibition allows those things to come out. There's craziness that happens in care homes. Annie went to many care homes to research and talk to all the people there that were residents and also the staff and the management, and portraying it this way, where you try not to make it a redemptive, sentimental kind of story, it can potentially cause distress to people suffering in their own actual lives if they watch it. So that's a pitfall I'm aware of. I'm unresolved about that. Another pitfall is like just purely as a, in a filmmaking and practical senses, it's difficult subject matter for people to address because I think, again, going to, back to primal, our own primal death anxiety, people don't want to see it because it reminds them of their own coming death. So it's not cheery subject matter. And another pitfall is getting it wrong. And getting it wrong is trying to be redemptive, in my opinion, trying to say, oh, it's such a, it can be a beautiful redemptive experience to have a family member with dementia. It's just not true. Maybe some people can, but 99% of the people just suffer. There can be real love and real connection, but it's brutal. Probably the biggest pitfall is getting it wrong, getting the information wrong. I tried to be as accurate as I could, but I'm sure I didn't get everything right.